Committee on Tax Reform is open. Good morning, everyone. Week two of this adventure, which I know is especially entertaining to Dr. Bueller.
I appreciate the entertainment.
We're going to continue looking at scenarios and stability of a commercial activity tax in states where it's been successful, states where it's not been, including states have had it for more than 80 years, like the B&O tax in Washington State. And in that, there are there's wisdom or lack of it, depending on your perspective, of having varying rates like the state of Washington does. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Warner for our discussion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. We had prepared for you last Thursday and didn't get to a look at kind of a state finance perspective of the proposed framework that you looked at on Tuesday, and then also the presentation given by the speaker with some specific numbers in it. But what we've done is try to look at this in a little bit longer framework. And, you know, when you're thinking about state finance, you really two primary issues come to mind. One is the growth over time. How does it respond to long-term growth in the economy? And secondly, how does it respond over the course of the business cycle? One of the features that we have emphasized about the corporate income tax is that over time, it has been shrinking relative to the economy. And we see that, we've seen that in the Oregon data, and we see it in the national data, and we see it in nearly all of the states that have a state corporate income tax. Now, there's a number of reasons for that. One is that we've seen an entity shift historically, and Chris has shown you that when you've looked at business income, that it's shifted away from C corporations toward other entity types like S corporations or partnerships or that are organized as LLCs. So that shift has gone on. We also have seen through our discussions about tax havens and how the distribution of U.S. affiliate income is spread throughout the world. And under the U.S. corporate income tax system, corporations are not required to report their income within the borders of the United States. They can keep them offshore. And then they pay their corporate income tax once they're repatriated back into the country. So that's obviously had an influence on what the corporate income tax base is for the country, but also for us, because we use the water's edge definition, and most states do, for calculating the corporate income tax. There's also been, over time, we've seen this looking at state policies, there is intense competition among states to try to attract capital. And that's had some downward pressure on rates, but it certainly had some increase in the tax expenditures, investment tax credits, and so forth to try to encourage investment. So those factors all come in to reduce the corporate income tax. So when you see that declining as a share of the economy over time, and so we would suspect, as we do our long-term projections and you look at what the state economist is projecting current law, that there is anticipation that the corporate income tax in general will be flat. So over time, it will not grow with the economy, and that's historically what we've seen. The other issue around the corporate income tax is that it's, if you think about that in economic terms, long term, we're saying it has a low income elasticity. Well, normally that means more stability if you have low income elasticity. Sales tax is a classic example, it has low long term income elasticity, but it's stable over the business cycle. The corporate income tax is not, because it's a net base. And that base is the product of two very large numbers, gross receipts and total costs. So those two big numbers, however they move, the difference between them grows or shrinks greatly during the business cycle. And that's why you see such volatility in the corporate income tax is during the recessions, many large successful corporations have no net taxable income, because their costs have not gone down nearly as much as their revenues have. And that's typically what you see happen. So what that means in terms of state finance is you have a revenue source that doesn't grow much over time, but is very volatile over the course of the business cycle. So we thought we would look at those two aspects just a little bit and give you a sense of what we anticipate. The first slide we put together is looks at the long-term trajectory for the general fund lottery revenue with the additional revenue put in from a 0.75% cat. So we've just plugged that in just as a straight amount to see without the corporate income tax. And you can see what it has done is put the state on a faster long-term trajectory as you pull out that flat corporate income tax, and then you plug in a commercial activity tax that you would anticipate would grow pretty close to the rate of the economy. Not as fast as a personal income tax, but it should grow at a rate pretty close to the overall economy. And this is what we're projecting. So out through the year 2025, you can see that we would anticipate you would get roughly about, with a 0.75 and elimination of the corporate, about $4 billion for that additional in revenue in that biennium through this higher projected growth rate. Now, if you look at incremental changes over time and how the forecast would be, and this would, you know, this would be how the forecast would be adjusted if something like this were to become law, you can see the increments going out into future biennia. You know, and you've talked a lot about with 17-19 general fund lottery, it's roughly about $1.5 billion is the expected additional revenue compared to last biennium. With a 0.75 cat in place, you'd be over, you'd be about $3.6 billion as the net increase from the prior biennium. And then as you go out into the future, you can see that the increments are still larger than what's projected under current law. So in this, you're replacing a flat corporate income tax with a gross receipts tax that's growing at a more steady pace over time and growing faster. Now, interestingly, if you think about this, you think, well, okay, does that mean that the state's revenue is going to grow at a higher percentage per biennium over time? And if you look at that, the answer is no, it's not. It's going to grow at a lower percentage over time. And the reason is, even though you're removing this flat corporate income tax, you now have a system that's more like Washington's in the sense their Washington's B&O tax is about 19% of their general fund. So you're plugging in something that would be a comparable size. So what that means is the personal income tax now, which is now 90% of the general fund, would drop to 80 to 75%. So now you have a more diverse general fund portfolio, and that portfolio is going to be more stable, but it's going to have a lower percentage growth over time. Hmm. So even though you're getting rid of this flat tax, you're putting a bigger tax that takes up a bigger chunk of the general fund than the current corporate income tax does.
Washington's B&O tax is 19% of their general fund. What is Oregon's under current law?
The Oregon's general fund, about 6% is from the corporate income tax. So to go to something like the comparable to Washington model, you basically triple your proportional amount. So again, you can see that now, of course, the thing to keep in mind about these numbers here is that these are all based on the latest forecast that you'll get an update on next Tuesday. The thing that these projections are based on are trends. As we've talked a number of times about forecasting, the trends from our state forecasts have been pretty much dead on historically over a long period of time. What we don't forecast very well are the turning points in the business cycle, when the recession is going to occur. So the general fund has grown roughly 10%. Over the long term. We would expect that to continue. But what we don't expect is that to be a steady 10%. So what we thought we'd look at from a cyclical standpoint is, well, how would you anticipate a gross receipts tax to respond over the course of the business cycle? So what I did was I went back to the Washington Department of Revenue and their files and dug up the previous biennium's business and occupation tax revenue by biennium going back to 2001-03 and looking at what was the percentage change in the B&O compared to the Oregon corporate income tax. So what was the percentage change from biennium to biennium? And this gives you an idea what the stability is in the system and how substituting a gross receipts tax for a corporate income tax may affect that stability over time. Now, the first biennium, you look at 0103, and this is not, it's not that there's a missing data point there. It's just that the first bar, there's a little, very tiny blue bar in 0103, which is almost flat. So what that means is in the 0103 recession, and I know, you know, some of you remember that vividly and not very fondly. That was the time of multiple special sessions. And Washington's B&O tax was affected by that recession. That was the dot-com bust. But you can see it was flat rather than negative compared to the peak 99.01, which is a peak of a long cycle. However, the corporate income tax in Oregon dropped by over 40%. So now that's a smaller number, not just because Oregon's smaller, but also it's a smaller share of our portfolio. But still, a 40% drop occurred in the 0103 biennium. Now, in 0305, the corporate income tax in Oregon bounced back and grew by over 40%.
Representative Smith.
Is it okay if we ask?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I just want to make sure I understand that fact correctly. From 2001 to 2003 to 2003 to 2005, there was almost an 90% swing. Am I reading that correctly?
Representative Smith, yes. Now, keep in mind, if you decline 40% and then go up 40%, it doesn't leave you in the same spot necessarily.
Right.
But what it means is that, yeah, that was the swing was 40% down to 40% up.
Which is 90.
Yeah. Percent. Which means you dropped almost 80, in half. Right. And then.
But if you go 45, really it's 45 and 45.
I guess.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood that. Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Riley.
So now I don't understand it. Because if we go down 41% and then back up 45%, that's putting us back where we were plus just a little or not quite.
Well, if you think about it, let's say you're at 100 million and you would drop 40, you would drop down to 60 million. And then you gain 40% off of that, so that would be another 45. So you'd be up slightly, yeah.
Yeah,
no,
it's
up
28. Not like you're yeah. It's 28, you're up not 45.
So it'd be slightly below where we
you'd
started.
It'd be below where you started.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
Because it'd be 40. It'd be 40% of 60.
Got it.
So you can see that. But in terms of, and of course, what you're normally looking at in terms of your budgeting decisions is, okay, what did we predict, number one, and where are we compared to where we were last biennium? So you can see the planning for this type of a revenue source is very difficult. Of course, at that time, too, we had the corporate kicker, and that was tripped in 03-05 when we had the bounce back. Now, in 05-07, you can see the B&O tax did not respond nearly as much in 03-05. It grew around 8% for the beginning. So it was still coming slowly. That was a relatively slow recovery, too. We think about the 09 through 17 recoveries being slow, but that one was, too, in terms of job growth and economic activity. So the B&O was reflecting that and then had pretty strong growth tied to the housing boom in 05-07, growing about 20%. Our corporate income tax was still relatively strong at that time. And then, of course, in the Great Recession, we see that the thing about the Great Recession is, compared to 01-03, was the timing of it. It started really in the middle of a biennium and went into the middle of the next biennium. So it really captures both 07-09 and 09-11 revenue impacts. You can see in 07-09 we dropped about 20% in our corporate income tax. The B&O grew in the neighborhood of 6% and then was essentially flat in 09-11 as the early stages of the recovery were coming into play for Oregon and for the profits, and you started to see the profitability rising, and we bounced back. The other thing that was going on in 09-11 was a significant policy change you made. This is not adjusted for policies. That was Measure 67. So those 67 numbers are in there. Otherwise, you would have seen a flat to down corporate income tax.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this chart is really interesting and useful, but it's also somewhat misleading. If you look at that last number, and let me ask a question and maybe a comment. That last number, the biennial average, it looks like it's about 9% or so for Washington and about 6 or 7 for Oregon. Is that close?
Yes.
And that's the biennial average. So in order to get the actual number difference, a relative difference, you'd have to multiply that by the number of data points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 data points, that's almost 20% difference, isn't it?
Over time.
Over time. In actual amounts, almost 20% difference, right. Adjusting for the fact that they start at different numbers in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, so in that sense, this chart actually minimizes the actual effect over time, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know if it minimized. The another way of looking at this would be to look at these percentage, to add up these percentage changes, and then look at what the average is. I didn't do that because that tends to overstate these big jumps up.
Right.
So what I did was I took the 9901 level for the B&O and the 9901 level for the state corporate income tax, and then compared 13-15 with that. And that's how I calculated the average biennial.
Right.
I just divided that by the number of biennials.
Thank you. One other quick comment, just really quick. Looking at this, it without doing all the arithmetic, it looks to me as though it takes 2 biennia each time for Oregon to catch up with what it lost in the recession before, whereas because the B&O tax never actually went down, they're continuing to grow every biennia.
Yes.
Dr. Warner, I know there are some people reluctant to embrace this commercial activities tax idea, as crazy as that sounds. But in the 2013-15 chart there, what's going on there? Tell me if I'm right. It looks like that sort of is easy. It's a good place to be if you're a commercial activity tax state in times of economic growth and recovery. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think in terms of kind of how this affects the tax base over time or taxpayers, you can see that basically there is this effect that when the economy goes into recession, you still owe on your because you're basing on your receipts. But then when times are good and the economy improves, you don't see that big jump in your liability either. So I think from the standpoint of a taxpayer, there's stability as well. Even though you have this downside that it's a cost that's relatively steady over time, regardless of what your net income is. So that's kind of the trade-off. And from the state, it's the trade-off is exactly the same, where what you're trading is a more steady revenue stream. You don't have those big peaks, but you also don't have the valleys, and you have a more steady revenue stream over time.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair House. So, what problem are we trying to solve for here? Are we trying to solve for adequacy of our revenue or stability of our revenue? In my, at least how I see it, if we have a long-term growth trend of 10%, that's pretty good. I think most of us personally in our businesses would like a 10% growth rate over the long term. But I understand the problems with stability. So what problem really are we trying to solve? And if it is stability, what other tools do we have to stabilize our revenue stream other than the gross receipts tax?
Representative Bueller, are you asking me or are you asking Dr. Warner?
Both.
Well, I think it's an astute question, and I think the stability is the policy that we're trying to fix. Adequacy is still an issue out there, and if we can do both, I think people would go there too, but stability is the policy problem that we're trying to fix, because the corporate income tax, as you've seen by those previous slides, is really becoming obsolete for all the reasons Paul described. It's unstable. We could probably put the Swiss Alps map up to match that chart too. And so if you just changed the policy to make it revenue neutral, I think Paul has calculated the rate of somewhere around 2.5%. And that would fix the policy. Adequacy is another more subjective answer. And I think that's what we all have to decide here is, okay, let's fix the policy, but at what rate? Or if this isn't the way to fix that policy, what's a better way to replace a corporate income tax?
Dr. Warner?
If I could just add something, Representative Mueller, I think that it also gets back to the initial discussion. While, you know, over a long period of time, it's true that our long-term growth would be slowed slightly by this kind of a shift. But normally, when you're looking at a volatile revenue source, and we think about the income tax, for example, personal income tax, volatility, you would think of, okay, well, it moves up and down with the economy, but also if the economy grows over time, it's responsive, which is what the personal income tax is. I mean, it has an elasticity greater than one. So it's going to be growing over time. It's going to bounce around a lot in the business cycle, but it's going to grow over time. The corporate income tax bounces around the business cycle, but over time it doesn't grow. So there is some trade-off between stability and adequacy there, but by substituting a revenue source, it's more stable, but it also has more responsive to the economy over time. It's going to stay pretty much the same share of the economy over time, whereas the corporate income tax is going to shrink as a share of the economy. At least historically, that's what it's done for a long period of time.
Just a quick follow-up.
Quick. Sure.
So I'd be interested in knowing what other tools we'd have to create stability other than just a gross receipts tax. So, and Mark, you've talked about this,
yep.
You know, rainy day funds, consumption tax, maybe thinking out of the box a little bit on consumption tax and maybe other devices or tools that other states are used, or maybe not, something that is innovative also.
Representative Mueller, Mr. Chair, we have looked at this a lot, particularly during the restructuring task force in 2008. We really spent a lot of time with them into reserve funds. You know, one of the things that we've looked at, of course, historically has been the kind of traditional U.S. retail sales tax. And that, when we plug in a retail sales tax into our portfolio, it's definitely the standard deviation drops significantly. When we compare with national numbers, we have a kind of a portfolio mix, how we look at how it changes with a different mix of taxes. So it's a retail sales tax for an income tax, you know, definitely reduces the variability. However, we have become, it's become increasingly clear that the sales tax suffers the same effect as the corporate income tax over time. And that's where you look at that. I've got a good chart from Washington Forecast Council I'll bring for the committee. But it shows the retail sales tax base in Washington has gone from 60% in 1979 to 38% now. So that's just it's untaxed services are a big part of that, and also the remote sales and internet. So the sales tax states have a stable revenue source, but their adequacy over time is a big issue for them.
It's dropping like a rock.
Senator Bertschinger, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Warner, as we look at all these different ways to raise revenue, try to stabilize the income for the state, and all these different schemes, and your projections, what would you say the margin of error would be in your projections as we look at all these different ways of raising revenue?
Senator Bertschinger, Mr. Chair, we have a margin of forecast error for our current general fund, and that is a standard deviation of about 7%. So one standard deviation either way would be about $1.4 billion for a $20 billion general fund. So that's the margin of error for a given biennium. However, as I said earlier, if you take we have a spreadsheet that goes back to the beginning of the modern age of forecasting in Oregon, which was 1979, and come all the way forward, and you sum up the errors from each biennium, they're less than 0.1%. And what that means is they're not accurate each biennium, but over time, the plus errors cancel out the negative errors. So it's an unbiased estimate. So again, I think we can get a decent handle on what the trend is. What we don't have a good handle on is that biennium to biennium fluctuation. So that's where you get into issues like rainy day funds and that kind of thing. The other thing I will say, just from a personal experience, I did have the experience of 4 years of forecasting retail sales taxes. And believe me, they're a lot easier to forecast than the personal income tax. However, there are, you know, components of the retail sales tax, construction components, and there's various equipment and so forth that are volatile. But nonetheless, it's easier to predict and it's more stable over time.
What, Mr. Chair?
Senator Burchard.
Well, if we change the way we collect taxes, there's going to be a reaction. And do we know what that reaction is going to be? I mean, there's going to be a reaction.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Berchiger, you're right. We don't know what it is. And ultimately, of course, what happens is if you were to make this significant change in the tax system, and 5 years from now we look back on it, one of the things I'm sure we would comment are all the other changes that happened in that 5 years besides just the tax. So it's always hard to parse out what that effect was. We do have our general equilibrium model that we try to based on empirical evidence and economic theory, try to parse through what those big picture effects would be. And we're going to go through some simulations with you on Thursday, and I'll talk about that at the end of the meeting, kind of what we're thinking of. But while that's not going to give you a precise sense of what will happen, and there's still definitely a significant margin of error there, it will give you an idea of kind of what the directions will be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that's all I had on that. And there was a number of questions that came up during Chris's discussion around examples. So he's put together a few more examples for you, and he's going to go through those with you. He had a number of questions from individual members, so this will give you a chance to try to follow through a little bit in some more specific kinds of situations and how this change might affect them.
Chris Allen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So what I have here, the normal process with examples is the push and pull of those is always to come up with something that's clean enough to convey a certain point, but then it leaves out a lot of other information. That's just kind of the nature. But one of the upsides is that they do spur some questions. And after the examples that I went through last week, we got some questions. So this information here is following the thread of those questions that we got, and it was basically around the incidence, if you will, or the application of the tax to which sales. And we're basically talking about sales in Oregon versus exports. So this is built from last time, so I kept trying to keep the format familiar because that helps with digesting the information. But the first example here, we have an S corporation and it's a lumber producer. And the key information here is the sales. The inputs and the margin were taken from last time just to have some sort of tie to the last one. So we're basically talking about a low margin business. It's a 3% margin. The key thing here though is the sales. So their inputs cost $300 million and their total sales are $350 million. And potentially, the commercial activity tax or the business activities tax here would be applied to sales, but only those sales in Oregon. So while in this example, they're a low-margin business, they have $310 million of sales, only $20 million is sold in Oregon. The $290 is exported outside of Oregon, so the CAT, the 0.75%, would be applied only to the $20 million. And so that turns out to be about $143,000 of tax just on the Oregon sales. Similarly, we have an LLC, it's a farmer, another small margin business, only 2%, and their inputs altogether are $400 million, and the cost of that $400 million is used to produce sales of $410 million. That's the nature of the low margin. And there were concerns that questions I got was applying this 0.75% to the $410 million. And that's not how it would work. What we're talking about here is a destination-based tax. So it's only the sales in Oregon. So this farmer here, only $5 million of sales are in Oregon. The other 405 are exported. So the tax gets applied to the $5 million, not the full $410 million. And then the third example here, I just went with a sole proprietor, a graphic designer. So it's a much smaller business. Most of it's in-state. So they have $1.5 million of inputs for software and computers and that kind of thing. And their output is $2.2 million, but $2 million of it is sold in-state. And their margin is 32%. So the CAT would be applied only to the $2 million in Oregon. So it's most of their sales in this small business, and they're going from a high margin. Now, what I didn't include in here was the income tax piece of this, because we start going down. The simpler I made it with respect to the sales and the destination of the sales, the more complicated the income tax calculations became. So most of the questions focused on the sales and the location of those sales. So that's what those examples really focus on.
Consider focus.
And just to complicate your life, since the other sheet has income tax on it, the policy decision is a comparison between present income tax and the CAT and VAT. Is it going to be completely miserable in your life to go back and add the column for income tax and figure it out, even though it's difficult?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, no. I'm viewing this as a step-by-step process. Most of the questions were on the destination. And so I wanted to focus on that piece here, because there are some nuances here around on that. So I wanted to drive that point home and have that discussion. But ultimately, you're absolutely correct. It's the comparison of the two. And so that's kind of a next step.
Right. So we'll get to see the next step after your life is miserable, right?
You can see the next. Yeah, I'll work on the next step. Yeah.
Thank you.
The third piece here is one of the nuances I was referring to. So here we have a C corporation, and it's a manufacturer without nexus in Oregon. So they're located somewhere out. They're located outside of Oregon, and they have $500 million cost of inputs, and they produce $600 million. That's their sales. Now, of those sales, they make $150 million of sales into Oregon, and the other 450 are just not Oregon. We're talking about a non-Oregon business who is selling into the state, and because they don't have nexus, they don't have any physical location here, they make these sales into Oregon. Under current law, they are not subject to the corporate income tax, so they pay no corporate income tax. This is, you've heard us refer to Public Law 86272. It's a federal law. It prevents the states from taxing corporations who have a minimal connection to a state. They basically lack nexus. They don't have a significant tie to the state. But under a commercial activities tax, a destination-based tax, the $150 million of sales that they make into Oregon become taxable. And so that $150 million of sales is multiplied by the 0.75% rate to get about $1.1 million in tax.
Representative Fernandez, did you have a question?
I do have a question. This is assuming we don't have a cap on the total sales. For example, if we say those companies that sell over 5 million, would this rate would be applicable?
The Chair Haas, Representative Hernandez, I think the 5 million is the threshold. And here, some of the parameters of the tax right here is we're talking about a minimum tax of $250 and a rate of 0.75% of sales above a million. And the speaker's plan that you heard the other day had a minimum tax, and the rate applied, it was a 0.95% rate applied to sales above $5 million. So it wasn't a cap on sales, at least for the rate. It was where the rate became applicable. So in this example, the way the policy I have here, the $1 million, if you have sales less than $1 million, you only pay the $250. The rate is not applicable to sales under $1 million.
And that's total, follow-up, Chair. And that's total sales, not just those that happen in Oregon?
No, these are Oregon sales.
Just Oregon sales.
Yes.
As a follow-up, could you give a off the top of your head, Chris, on the C corporation example, manufacturer out of state selling in, would an example be a pharmaceutical company selling drugs in? Can you give a couple examples of what might be this type of C corporation?
Yes, it's we're talking about tangible personal property. So medication would fall into that. Pharmaceuticals would fall into that. Machinery, desks, computers, anything that's tangible that you can touch. So to the extent that the Oregon economy consumes these products from businesses that are not located here and they just sell into the state, that's basically what we're talking about. They're not located here. They have no physical presence. You can't go to the store in Salem or Bend or Portland. They're just selling into the state. And this federal law, 86272, says that if there's only this minimal, if you're only making sales into a state and you have no other presence there, and it gets a little more complicated. I am simplifying it here. The rules get a little more complicated. But the state cannot charge the corporate income tax on those companies. But under, and this was a point of contention when Ohio implemented their CAT, and it went through the court system, and some companies objected to that, and I don't know how far they got in legal proceedings, but it all turned out to be constitutional, and basically it's the concept of economic nexus. So you have a corporation who is benefiting from Oregon's economy by selling products in the state. And so because it's not an income tax, this federal law doesn't apply, and the Oregon cap would apply to those sales.
And so generally speaking, in this particular C corporation manufacturer you just described, these corporations today are paying no tax but doing business in Oregon, correct?
Correct.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. And just as a follow-up, how big a factor are companies in that situation in our business community?
Well, we don't actually know because they're not subject to the income tax right now, so they're not filing, so we don't have any information on them. We are pursuing avenues to see if what information we can find to get a better answer to that mm-hmm. question. So it is something we're working on, but as of right now, I'm afraid we don't have a good number on what that is. But we have anecdotal stories of companies who purchase their equipment as part of their input process for their manufacturing. So you have a company who is located here and they're manufacturing something and they're buying inputs into their product process. Those companies would become taxable.
Okay. Whatever information you can come up with on that, mm-hmm. I think would be helpful.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, not meaning to be anal here, are you rounding up on some of your numbers?
There is rounding, yes.
On the sole proprietor, did you round up on that?
Are you?
We'll catch up. I'm coming up with different numbers on my math.
I couldn't get that.
So I'm taking, can I just use just very, very briefly? On the sole proprietor graphic designer, mm-hmm. I take 2 million, I subtract 1 million,
mm-hmm.
and then I multiply it times
0.075. 0.075.
0.075. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
It's okay.
So long, officer and me.
We're going to bring next.
It's the loan officer. Sorry.
7.5% is a lot higher.
Thank you.
Okay, I do the same thing. Next hearing, in fact, we're going to bring a fifth grade math teacher.
Perfect. Perfect.
I would like to go back to Representative Marsh's question for both Chris and Paul. When you say anecdotal evidence in terms of these unknown manufacturers, is it not correct, though, that the analytical study of the sales tax in other states and the fact that it has dropped by 30-some percent and those economies continue to grow, that 30% margin is really a large group of these anonymous entities that are selling into states. That's why there was a shift from the sales tax and the fact that sales tax is failing. Again, sales tax is failing in most states. And it's that group that's out there that nobody seems to be able to capture except the National Security Agency and obviously the marketing entities are sending those emails. But they can get it and we can't. So is that correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, it has been an annual series of estimates of the amount of internet sales, and the sales tax states have funded this research out of the University of Tennessee, and so we can look back on that and get a sense of kind of those internet sales. But in terms of kind of the commercial activity or being O-type tax, you know, we have a lot broader array of things that are that could be you know, that could be affected by a switch in this, to this destination base. We do know in discussions with Ohio that that was one of their initial experiences from introducing the cap was they began to basically send bills and require filing by a lot of corporations that were out of state that had not filed in the past, and they received legal challenges from that, and in general were successful. So we know anecdotally that's the case. Quantitatively, I think we can get you a number on what the internet sales estimates are for Oregon.
I would assure, since, you know, I live in rural Oregon and I keep the rural postal carriers fully employed on Mondays and Wednesdays with a stack of catalogs about this deep, about 18 inches deep. I'm assuming also that, you know, if I order from Cabela's is not a good example, but if I order from, you know, Major Surplus or any one of the women's catalogs or whatever that comes out there, and that's shipped into the state under a program like this, they would have Nexus, and presently they do not. Is that not correct? So the whole mail order industry is another reason for the decline in the sales tax, too. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay, so the next piece I wanted to touch on was this bottom table. And this is a combination. There's been a lot of discussion of pyramiding and also this in Oregon versus exported. And so here I put together a fictionalized process of going from what I call tree to table. So at each production level and how the sales and the tax would be applied. So in the beginning, we have the cutting of the tree. And I've just ignored the cost of natural resources right now, so we're starting with zero there. There's a value added of $5 million from the process of cutting the trees and selling them. So this, the company sells their $5 million in trees. $1 million is sold in Oregon and $4 million is exported. So the CAT is applicable to the $1 million, and they would pay the minimum tax. That's the $250, because they're right at the $1 million threshold. So one of the places they sell to is a processor. The processor buys the $1 million. So it's simplified so that the entire $1 million in Oregon sales goes to this one processor. They have their $1 million of input. They do their thing. They process the trees into lumber, and their value added is $5 million. And so together they sell their product for $6 million. $1.5 million is sold in Oregon and $4.5 million is exported. is applied to the $1.5 million in Oregon. So that's about $4,000. That's basically the way the arithmetic works. It's $250 plus 0.75% of $500,000. So all of their Oregon sales, the $1.5 million, is sold to this lumber wholesaler. Now, one of the key assumptions, and I just did this for simplicity here, is a full forward pyramiding of the tax. This is just for simplicity's sake. I contemplated other examples that went down different avenues, but it made it more complicated. So this is really just one piece of that. And so that's a full-on assumption here. So the $4,000 in CAT is included, it's passed on from the processor to the lumber wholesaler. So their cost of input is $1.504 million. So basically without the CAT, their input cost would have been 1.5, now it's 1.504. They do their thing and they add $2 million of value, and their sales are $3.504 million. And in Oregon, their sales are $0.904 million and they export the other $2 million. Now this is here's another implicit assumption that I made in putting this example together, is that the tax can't be exported. And generally that's in line with many assumptions where the tax stays in state, and because all of the exporters, they're all price takers, so they can't pass that tax along in the export market. So that's why all of the tax stays within the state here, the way I've assigned it. But most of the sales do get exported. Now, because their Oregon sales are $904,000, they're a minimum taxpayer. They don't hit that $1 million threshold. So their CAT is $250. So that $904,000 of in-Oregon sales are sold to the furniture manufacturer. The furniture manufacturer spends that $904,000. They add a lot of value because they're producing the furniture, so it's $10.1 million of value added. And they sell their furniture for a total of just over $11 million. Within here, $3 million plus the $4,000 are sold in Oregon, and then $8 million are exported. Again, we're talking about a primarily export business again. And so their minimum tax is about $15,000. And again, that's the rate for the sales above a million. So that $15,000 is added to, it's all shifted forward to the retailer. So the retailer's inputs are $3.019 million. That's the $15,000 of CAT to the wholesaler and then the $4,000 from way back at the processor. So their inputs are $3.019 million. They add value of a million and they sell $4.019 million. And 2.519 is sold in-state and 1.5 million is exported. So this is the one example where they're not primarily an exporter. The majority of their sales are sold in the state, and their CAT would be about $12,000, which is a function of, again, just the Oregon sales. So I tried to come up with something here that really got at this whole notion of the export sales and how export sales aren't affected by the CAT. And we're talking about a destination base, so it's only applied to sales in Oregon. So the more sales are exported, they're not subject to the tax. But it does show the pyramiding, but this is full forward pyramiding for everything, which isn't what OTM shows, which is something we'll get to on Thursday.
Good. All right. Appreciate those examples. Questions? Representative Barnard.
Thank you. You don't really know that the tax isn't exportable, do you? It depends a lot on the market. And I guess that your term is price elasticity.
Correct, yeah.
So this assumption is the most conservative one you could make with the assumptions you're making, and that is that it's impossible to pass the price along outside of the state, even though that in real terms may not be true.
That's correct. It's very complicated. It depends on market power. It depends on the individual markets. It depends on a lot of factors. Depend on if we're talking other states, other countries.
The uniqueness of the table.
The uniqueness of the table, for example. If it's in high demand, then the greater the demand for this particular table, if you will, then the greater the ability to export the tax. If it's a generic table, then it's less likely to be.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One thing, Mr. Chair, just to add to that, the Tax Foundation does do some annual estimates of import and exporting of taxes by state, and we can bring that in for the committee to get an idea. Of course, where you tend to see the exporting is primarily through the severance taxes, mineral states, oil and gas, tourist states like Hawaii and Nevada. But that would give you some comparisons. Oregon is a net a importer of taxes more than we export. And that has to do with our industry mix.
And import means we pay more.
We pay some of the Alaska taxes, yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Questions of Chris Alanak. All right, thank you, sir. On Friday, we are going to be looking at computer simulations.
On Thursday.
Computer simulations of, I gave Rob a heart attack. And there's a huge distinction between computer modeling and just number crunching on Excel sheets. So, Dr. Warner, could you walk us through that, what that process entails?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did, those of you who were on the committee in 2015, remember that you had directed us to look at some tax reform options. Can you put that up? So, and we produced a report and went through it with both of the revenue committees. And this is the report, analysis of options. And this is if you want to do a little advanced reading, this will give you an idea of what we'll be talking about on Thursday. We have a section there called Analytical Tools and describes what our Oregon Tax Incidence Model is, what it's designed to do. It's essentially designed to look at how to change a major change in tax policy will work through the economy, and in the long run, which we assume is 5 years or more, in the long run, how prices, wages, employment, distribution of the tax burden will be affected. So it will give you a sense of what we think the macro effects on the state will be. We do have 80 different industry sectors, so we can trace through what those are. We can look at some idea of where we may get some pyramiding and intermediate prices driven up, what the ultimate effect would be on consumer prices. But this is the OTIM model is a long run model. I call it a capacity model. It's based on what the productive capacity of the economy is. It's not a cyclical model where we're looking at unemployment, that kind of thing. We're saying, how does an economy grow over time? And it basically grows through an increase in its labor force, through in migration, or through capital coming into the state. So it's labor and capital coming into the state that will affect the capacity for growth. And we can look at some different scenarios. We'll put together some for you for Thursday and go through the output with you. And then again, if you look at the appendix for this report, you can see what we did here. We did look at a number of CAT scenarios where we plugged in some estimates of what a commercial activity would bring. We looked at some revenue neutral scenarios. We looked at some revenue loss scenarios and some revenue gain scenarios. So that give you an idea of kind of that's the output that you'll be looking at. And we'll go through that with you on Thursday and address any questions you have. And then, you know, as you progress and kind of looking at some different variations off the framework, then, you know, we can look at what those implications might be for making those changes. And then we can come back with you and kind of do an interactive process. As I've told some of you, one thing about this kind of modeling, it can be addictive because when you see it, it raises other questions that you want to address. And again, it's a model. It's a simplification. It's certainly not, some magical truth about a very complicated economy, but it does give you some sense of trade-offs. It gives you a sense of kind of direction, magnitude, and I think it's something that's helpful in you as you kind of think through the process and what are the ramifications of different policy decisions.
It does give you some science to actually make more precise public policy when it comes to taxes. Okay, final questions for Dr. Warner or for the day? Okay, thank you all. We'll see you Thursday. We are adjourned. Okay, thank you all. We'll see you Thursday. We are adjourned.